All right, welcome to episode 84 of the Bobbycast, and Busby's here, which the first I heard from you is, yeah, I'm buddies with Keith Urban.
Yeah.
That was the first I'd ever heard of, like, you in the way of, like, wow, because when Keith Urban says something, I'm like, let me listen. Because one, he's really kind.
Yeah.
But when Keith Urban talks musically,
yeah,
you're like, I should listen, because Keith Urban, probably the smartest guy I know musically.
He's deep, man.
So deep. Like, I've seen him take songs and just take it to, like, I have friends who are going to cut songs, and Keith will go in the studio with them, yeah, and go, and my friends think they're good, and they're like, oh, yeah, I'm terrible. Like, I used to think I was good until Urban came in. So that's the first I'd heard of you, when you did some tracks on Ripcord with Keith.
Yeah.
But, and I was like, Busby, is that like Buzz, like a B? But it's really your last name.
It is, yeah. It was brutal growing up with that name, but
would they do the Busby thing?
Oh, yeah. Busby, Bugsme, Buzzbutt, all that stuff.
But your name's Mike Busby.
Yeah, exactly.
So is that an artist thing where you like just call me Busby? Or is that just Mike is common?
I had a buddy of mine suggest I just go by that professionally. A lot of people would just call me Busby. You know, I'd introduce myself, hey, Mike Busby, nice to meet you. And everyone would just forget the mic and just call me Busby. So I just kept going by Busby. It just evolved.
And I have a lot to talk about with you, because as I've been researching, I've become a bigger and bigger fan. Oh, and also, I have friends that now that have worked with you, like Marin.
Yeah.
I took Carly out with me on tour, stand up.
Yeah.
So I have a lot, you and I have a lot of similar friendships.
Yeah.
And but as I started to look you up a bit and like go deep into it, and especially with the instruments and the jazz background, like I want to get into all that.
Sure.
But I always like to start with something that just makes people go, pfft. And I want to play this demo, because you wrote Holy.
Yeah.
And this is you singing.
Wait, Unholy?
Yeah.
No, I didn't sing that one.
This is you singing?
No. Yeah, that's Nate.
You know what? I was like, who's Nate, by the way?
Nate Seifert, who I wrote it with.
Okay, so great, but you wrote it. This is Nate singing.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't sound like you. When you started talking.
No. Yeah, I talk like this, but I sing like this.
Okay, so you wrote Holy.
Yeah.
You're not singing the demo, though.
No,
okay, this is the demo of Holy.
Yeah.
I've often said there have been about two songs this year that I think have been really screwed by country radio. One of them was Holy, and one of them was Body Like a Back Road. Because they were so popular, people wouldn't let them stay popular.
Right.
And I thought Florida Georgia Line and Sam both got screwed in the factory that is country radio and make number one, get rid of it.
Yeah.
And I thought this song should have been number one for on the radio chart for 5, 6, 7 weeks. It was that big of a song.
Yeah.
Did you feel the same way?
I mean, as a writer, you hope something like that would happen. And,
but you
and
write a lot of, you have a lot of hits. Did you feel different about this one?
Like, yeah, no, it felt very impactful. And it's interesting. The tricky thing is it just went up really quick, too, because of the momentum of them and then how big it was. So it was very impactful, but it kind of like came and then went. You know what I mean? And
too,
I mean,
it's, too quickly.
It has, yeah, it has a life after that, like because of the type of song it is and the artist that they are. But yeah, I mean, I think it should have been 4 or 5 weeks at least.
Don't you think that it's killing the culture of country music and the fact that songs come and go so fast? That when we were kids, songs in general, because we'll use country as the format, they would last for 8, 9 weeks.
Totally.
And they became anthems. And we think of our life because of these songs. Like, we remember where we were. And now song's number one, boom, it's gone. It's gone.
No, absolutely. I mean, it seems like the disconnect. I mean, to be extreme about it, a buddy who was my mentor told me back in the day, the DJs would show up with their record collection, and that's what you'd play, right? And now, obviously, and you're one of the DJs who seems to play a lot of what you play. I remember driving probably a year and a half ago and hearing you play Marin early on and going, oh, my gosh. You know, like before it was really catching, you were like really playing that. And thank you, man. You've been such a supporter of artists early on. But it's a machine, and I understand. I understand both sides of it. I understand how it sort of needs to be in this modern time, but it doesn't necessarily allow for the context of A, the DJ helping decide those things sometimes, and then more importantly, truly, is the fan response. And if the fan's responding, let it go, you know?
I agree so much. And to me, the weird thing is that a song can be number one, and then the next day, everybody starts to go, poof.
Yeah.
A song doesn't go from being awesome
to
sucking in 12 hours.
No, it just gets dropped off all of the playlists, and so it's gone.
And because of that, I think inevitably, we're not in 10 years going to have, and again, we're never in 10 years going to have the same we've ever had. In the history of the world, 10 years is never the same.
Yeah, totally.
It's never the same. But I think these songs that just remind, like, we had songs. Like, I can remember hearing Indian Outlaw on the radio. I can remember hearing Smells Like Teen Spirit on the radio. Yeah. I know, I feel myself and know where they were.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's going to happen anymore.
It's a similar thought if you want to go all the way back to, like, there'll never be another Beatles, in part, for many reasons, but in part that we live in a different world. Like, part of what made the Beatles, besides the talent, was it was there was a mystery. You know, you couldn't just get on Instagram and go look at what Paul was doing this morning. You know, I could be on your Instagram and what was Bobby doing today and see that and vice versa and whatever. There's no mystery. And even though you and I are just meeting for the first time, some of it feels like we already know each other because of the friendships, but also social media and life and the overlap and the modernity, as it were. Back then, there was just everything was like, I think that maybe. And so when the Beatles landed, man, it was like literally when they landed, people were there in mass freaking out because they didn't know what was going on. They didn't really know what they looked like in person. They wanted to go see it and feel it, you know. So that kind of excitement's just, you can't recreate it.
I think options also create that. Yeah. Listen, there were three TV channels.
Totally.
And you're on one of the three TV channels. Yeah. You have, at worst, you know, 25% of the audience.
Yep.
Period. We have 500 channels now.
Totally.
I mean, we're looking at, just as an example, a TV network came to me and said, hey, I want you to do the show. They're like, hey, you should come to the show. And I was like, the show doesn't feel right. I didn't want to do this particular TV show. And they were like, but you don't understand. Like, you'll do this show and you'll have 250,000 people watching. And I was like, guys, not to be a dick, but I have 3 million people that listen to my show live and another 3 million that listen on podcasts digitally every day.
Totally.
And back in the day, it was 10 times that.
Totally.
Like, we're all losing our... It's such a world of like an interstate and cars driving by.
Yeah.
And like, do you like the right... Buy a right car.
Totally.
You had to like it while it was there.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. The turnover rate for everything just seems a lot quicker. And that's... you know, it's not just a business and marketing conversation, as you know. It's also a creative conversation.
Do you think it's killing art? Do you think it's killing art, or is it making it better? Because I do see arguing on both sides. I'm asking you. Do you think
I'm not trying to cop out. I think it's a bit of both. Like, it depends on, you know, everything evolves, right? So art has to evolve, and it has to be able to function in that new society. I mean, it's like, did the computer kill art, music making? I don't know. It depends if you're a tape machine purist. I love the sound of a great tape machine record. But I also love the things that I can do in a computer and manipulate something.
Do you ever see Jim Morrison talk about the computer? You ever see the... Mm-mm. It was probably 77, you know, obviously before he died. And he was doing an interview and he was like, you know what the future... And it blew me away. He was like, you know what the future of music is? And again, you're talking about in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he's... By the way, for those listening, Jim Morrison, lead singer of The Doors. Very famous band. He died way early.
Yeah.
And he was like, it's computers.
Totally.
In the 70s, he was saying this.
Yeah, and he was probably more spot on than he could have ever imagined because, as you well know, there's a sector of music that is almost specific. Everything is the computer. You know, it's not like country music typically involves live instrumentation still, and it's becoming more prevalent again in pop. But with a lot of dance music, it's like everything is literally in the computer. And to me, that's not a better or worse, or it's just a different way of doing it. It's like, can you still be creative within those confines, you know?
So where we would have songs, predict what these 13-year-olds will have. What will they be able to look at in the art world and go, you know, this really reminds their Snapchat story?
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing about it. That train of thought, even though it's logical and I get it, it goes to the thing of where people literally thought we'd be flying in cars right now, you know, when conceptually it's possible we could go buy a $150,000 car that flies, right? But it's not it's not commonplace. So even though technology is evolving really quickly, there's still what people want to accept as normal formats is moving way less quickly. So songs will exist, I think, forever. They really will. What kind of songs, what length of time is acceptable? You know, will they go shorter? Is it going to be 2 minutes?
And they're already going shorter.
Yeah.
Are they telling you, because again, I'm lucky enough to be in the high level. I get to see research. What happens is with music is we'll take it and I say we, I don't pay for it, but I get to see the results of it. We'll take it and have thousands of people listen to these songs and rate them. Songs are on the radio, songs they haven't heard, and then you get scores from M scores to, I mean, it's sometimes you over data yourself.
Yeah.
And I've seen some really great songs not be scored highly. Now, in the opposite, but it's data. And what we're seeing is that people get bored with anything over about 3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, it was pointed out to me that they're speeding things up, you know.
And not only are they shortening, but they're speeding them up.
Yeah.
Meaning they'll take a song, and I'm totally doing industry secrets here,
yeah,
but they'll take it and speed it up 3%.
Yeah.
So the song even moves faster. And if you ever hear a song on the radio and you're like, and then you play it back, you know, on your computer, and you're like, but it seems a little slower. It's because radio plays them a little faster and they want them shorter.
Yeah. It's interesting, man. As a writer, I mean, I still write stuff that I feel, right? That hopefully goes without saying. That is truly the case. But I'm also, I have a, I like business. I have an inclination towards it. And it's, they're, to me, those aren't necessarily at odds. And so I've had this understanding of the reality that in a business sense, as songwriters, we're selling ads on a radio station. We are and so is your morning show in the sense of like, they want to either hear you and then hear the ad and come back to hear you, or they're going to hear our song and we're going to keep them on there so they can ultimately hear the ad. And I'm okay with that. It is what it is. I've chosen to be in the Billboard business, not Billboard magazine, but selling billboards, right? I did not choose to be in the, I'm not trying to paint the Mona Lisa and not degrading our art. I think you can make amazing art in that context, but it's just a different thing. It's like we're not just sitting in our bedrooms writing songs because we're writing exactly what we want to say, and maybe someone will listen to it once. We're trying to write stuff that means something to us and makes us feel stuff, but that will reach the masses. And so that's the format that we're allowed, is to be able to put it on radio or to put it on Spotify. And we're basically either selling a subscription of Spotify or keeping someone on a radio station so that they listen to the ad. And it's, of course, needed because you got to have the money to do the thing. And I'm okay with that. It's just a funny thing when you think about it, you know?
You get angry as a songwriter that right now it's kind of the Wild West and you guys are not getting paid what you should be getting with streaming services?
It's very complex situation and very frustrating, truly. And I've been constantly trying to be engaged as much as I can, different ways. And I had an interesting conversation with someone the other day who represents a very well-known, established old school producer in LA, and they both had invested in Spotify, and we were talking about some of that stuff, and it was like, you know, I don't fault Spotify specifically. Like, the if I was going to fault anybody more than anything, it's truly the legislation that the government putting the legislation on us as writers that we have. I mean, we're literally, imagine going, hey, you know, can you come to a show in New York, and you sign a new contract or whatever it is, and they go, you want to charge X amount of dollars, but the government says, no, you can only charge a quarter of that. That we're going to regulate that, right? Because we think DJs make too much, or it's a monopoly, or whatever it is. No, when you go do a show, if you're playing with your band or anything, you negotiate your rate or whatever that is. You know, it's like it's fair market. I can't do that as a writer with 2/3 of my income. One part of it I can, the sync, when you get something placed on film and TV, we go, we'll negotiate that rate. And they've also, through that process, realize that half of it should be for the records, half of it should be for the song, right? So if someone gives you a $10,000 placement to have your song on some movie or something, half of it goes to the recorded side, half goes to the song. But when it comes to mechanical rates, when it comes to performance, all of that is dictated, it's very complexly so, but dictated by different legislations that effectively does not allow me to go, here's this water, I want to sell it to you for $100. And you go, I'm not paying $100, I'll pay 10. And I go, 20. You go, 15. Okay, cool. We can't do it. That's the main issue to me. And it, you know, some people want to get mad at Spotify. Some people want to get mad at Pandora, whatever. I think that's the future. And I think Spotify's and Pandora's and Apple's are actually in large trying to do the best they can for the most part. But we aren't even allowed to come to the table and negotiate fairly for what we want to be represented by financially.
The weird part of it is too, is again, I'm with you. I don't think the Spotify's, Apple's are doing anything wrong. They're not breaking any laws because there are no laws.
Well, the only laws are keep us from negotiating. To go back to the 40s.
When I say no laws, there are no current – there is no law reflective as to what's happening right now. With the – back. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
Who came in and she sang background? I love her as a writer. She told me that she – when she Spotify, she sings backing tracks. She gets paid more than when she writes the songs.
Oh, yeah.
Jesse Alexander.
Yeah.
She was like, I get paid more for – and she's had millions and millions of streams of The Climb from Miley, I Drive Your Truck from Lee Bryce. She's like, I get paid more to sing background vocals
totally
than to stream. But the laws are antiquated. I mean, they're so old. And when I say no laws, Why? What's beeping, by the way?
I don't know.
Like, is this place had to blow up?
Oh, is it the chair? I'll try to sit still.
No. There's like a beep. There's like a bomb or something about to go off in the house. My point was, I thought Holy got screwed. Back to the whole thing. I really think that, you know, in this song, and, you know, here's. Go holy, 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 I'm high. And the story with the song, and you can set the record straight.
Yeah.
Did someone, because Bieber passed, had it, and you thought he was going to cut it, but was there someone before Bieber?
No, almost simultaneously. Bieber was interested in it, and we did a deal for the song, like as producers, because I co-produced that demo that effectively was going to be the master. And then there was another artist who I don't want to specify who it was. You probably wouldn't. It was a new artist.
So it's not a thing that's out there.
No, not at all. And I'm only not specifying because I want to be cool to him. There's nothing wrong, but, like, you know, he was an artist who was on a TV show and got signed by a prominent record person, and that person did a really aggressive deal to try to sway us from giving it to Bieber, which we agreed to the terms, but we said, but we're still not giving it to you until we know what's up with Bieber, because of course that would have been, of the options we had, that was the best option, just business-wise. And Bieber wound up passing on it, so we cut it on that other artist. So, and they paid us as producers, so it was already locked in. We couldn't just go and say, hey, we want our song back in a normal situation. And about a month before we had been told it was going to be released, my publisher, Sarah from BMG, hits me up and goes, hey, what's going on with that song, Holy? I think it's what FGL's looking for. And my head was like, what? Like, because I wrote it with Nate, who at the time hadn't written anything in Nashville, to my knowledge, pop writer. This guy, Will Larson, who's pop producer, like total in LA, thinking for a pop pitch, that whole thing. And the fact that they resonated like they did. So I had to call Seth up, their manager, and just be like, man, these are some of the business complications we're facing, and I'm not sure what's going on with this artist, but I can't necessarily easily get the song, but I, of course, would love you guys to cut it. So we discussed it, and then we went back to the label and said, yo, you're not going to release this song. You're going to drop this artist, aren't you? Can we have the song back? And they basically just gave us the song back.
Is there almost...
And sadly, he got dropped. Not okay. Because of that, but he was planning to get dropped.
Is it almost a thing where, and maybe it's not, where if you say, hey, we'd like to have this song back, do they kind of feel like, okay, yeah, you can have the song, but you owe us one? Is that ever a thing, even if it's not stated?
Yeah, I would think so, depending on the person. It's a little more complicated in this case because they paid us a lot of money as producers on that particular track because of how badly they wanted the song. And in the pop world, it's a bit more Wild West with all that stuff. You know, it's like how much you charge as a producer is... whatever you can get, basically. And it can be large numbers, and it depends on how much somebody wants a song and if someone else wants it. And
so a bidding war for producing,
literally, really. Yeah. And this particular label person who wrote the check for the second artist, he's known for liking to write checks, like, and if he really wants something, he'll put his money where his mouth is. It went even a step further, which this is just a little bit of a behind the scenes into that world. So we did something called a kill fee. It's not even an advance, but it was like, if it's not released as the first single by such and such a date, you have to give us another check that was actually over double of what the producer fee was. And it just guaranteed that we would actually have the first single. Because if we were going to give it to this artist who was a new artist who had no track record, which we'd love for him to have a hit with it, because a hit would be a hit. But it was a bigger risk for us, so their commitment was demonstrated through that thing. So they had already paid us as producers, and the kill fee was coming up in a few weeks. And that's when I call Seth and I explain the whole situation. He's like, dude, we can't do a kill fee. And I'm like, yeah, no, man. I know how Nashville works, and it's a totally different way how I work here. And I was like, well, can it be a single? He's like, I can't guarantee it, but it probably will be. We're going to go five deep, and, you know, it's a great song or whatever. Hits me a month later. He's like, it's the first single. Here's the video. And we're like, whoa. And the rest was history. I mean, it was literally like, ju, ju, ju.
Is there a bit of you, though, when Bieber passes on it? Because that's a money-making machine.
Oh, crazy.
I mean, crazy money-making.
Yeah.
Where you're like, oh.
More than a bit. I mean, quite frankly, it's, you know. And for me, it's, you know, I have a family to feed. And, you know, I've been very, very fortunate to have hits and a career and all those things. But every one of our situations is that. It's like, you know, even if you get the Bieber cut, will it be a single? You know, of course, right now it will be a hit, but there was a time where it was like, he's a big artist, but will it be a hit at radio, you know? Or this new kid who cut it, like, we have the single, but is he going to break through? And all of those things are just this emotional roller coaster, because not only do you write the song with all this emotion and then send it out into the world, but when that stuff starts playing out, man, it's just like, oh, because you at first it is, oh, Bieber wants it. I mean, it was Bieber wanted it so much, quote unquote, meaning that was so legitimately happening that I remember being out there. I was in Nashville at the time. They're like, can you fly back immediately? We want to cut his vocal tomorrow. I was supposed to go to Rick Rubin's house and cut the vocal with Rick on Bieber. And then that literally last minute the night before didn't happen, with no explanation other than he'll cut in a couple weeks and whatever.
Oh, and then when that starts to happen.
You never know, because that could totally happen, and then it could be – that's the weirdest part about what we do. It's like you can't get too attached to all those things. I've had songs that literally I was told would not even be on the album, then made the album, and I was told, well, they won't be a single, and then they were a second single. Like my first hit was that.
You know? Two questions that come to this, and I don't want to forget either one of them. First, Rick Rubin, but I want to go to the you talk about album cuts. So we'll talk to writers. Say, hey, I get an album cut.
Yeah.
They don't make much money. Maybe if they get an album cut, they'll pay some of their guarantee back.
Yeah, exactly.
Know? And in the pop world, is it different? If you get an album cut, is there more money in the pop world, or is it basically
the same? It depends who it is. I mean, it's all obviously based on sales, and so a worldwide artist like Bieber, that's the main difference, is these artists can be worldwide. And so even if you, quote unquote, only sell a million records in the U.S., you can catch another 1, 2, 3 worldwide sometimes. And that's pretty rad.
So it's basically you can sell worldwide as a album cut what a single would sell in the country genre.
It would be hard to get that far, because basically it's for every song, it's a complex conversation, because in a lot of pop cuts, there's very few pop cuts that are even three writers. So let's assume it's a pop cut that's two writers, just for be conservative. Every song is worth about, let's say, 99 cents per album. So every million records is $90,000 for mechanicals, roughly, right? And then, of course, in that is your publisher and everybody. So most of that money goes back to recoup your draw, which you said. So if you have half of that, it's 45, and then if you have 4 million, that's gonna be $180,000, and then a country hit three way would be maybe 300 or something, about a million all told.
Right.
So it's so mechanicals exactly, are tricky, man.
But it does pay more to get a cut. And it does make sense. I never thought about the worldwide.
Yes, the worldwide thing. That's the big difference between pop and country.
Wow.
Very little worldwide with what country's doing right now. But that's changing, and I'm stoked about it.
Let me talk about Express Pros for a second. For just one corporate job, only 4 to 6 people will get interviewed for every 250 resumes. So, again, think about that. They get 250 resumes. They're only picking like 4 to 6 to even talk to. That's not good odds. So if you're counting on getting a job when you're uploading your resume, you probably shouldn't, because, again, not good odds. The fact is you need a real person talking to a real employer that has a real job, and that's where Express Employment Professionals come in. Express is your local resource to help you get a new job. So they have more than 18,000 jobs available weekly. That's 18,000 jobs that you need to get filled. That you can fill right now. They have jobs. Find the nearest office at expresspros.com, and Express never charges a job seeker to find employment. So your locally owned Express office can help connect you with available jobs in your community. Expresspros.com, manufacturing jobs, accounting jobs, customer service, information technology, you name it, visit the nearest Express office today. Speak with hiring professionals that can connect you to a job in your community. Expresspros.com to find a location near you. All right, I mentioned Rick Rubin, who will go down in history as one of the greatest of all time. Of everything totally. from you know, for me, like the Beastie Boys, like that's my music.
Totally.
Like my License to Ill,
yeah.
When I discovered that, it opened my eyes to, wow, you can look and sound and all this is certain, and none of it has to match anymore. Like that opened my eyes to anybody can do anything musically.
Yeah.
Have you spent time with Rick Rubin? Do you know Rick Rubin? You talk about going to his house. No. Have you ever met Rick Rubin?
I have not. I was excited about that.
That's when you said that. Sure. I was like, holy crap. I mean, he's done from, you know Rick. I mean, Rick Rubin. Yeah. He's getting skinny.
He has. Well, absolutely.
He's like a vegan now, right?
Well, the interesting part was when he was heavy, he's still a vegan. But he actually gave that up. And I think he probably still eats a lot of veggies, but introduced meat into his diet.
So he got skinnier with meat?
Well, I don't know what the correlation is.
That's not how it works with me. When I start eating a bunch of meat, I don't get skinnier. Yeah.
Well, the other interesting thing about him is, he's also not only a wildly successful record producer, but like the label side. You know, it's like, I mean, come on. Def Jam? Really? And then American.
He's one of the guys that if you're listening to this and you just Wikipedia Rick Rubin and you look at him. By the way, someone you look at and you go, oh, for sure, this dude's death metal.
Yeah.
But then you look at everything that he's been able to do in all formats and all genres.
Yeah.
I would recommend people listen to this to just to Wikipedia Rick Rubin and look at what he's done and his catalog.
There's an interesting aside to me, which is that some people who want to be critical will talk about how like he's not always in the studio or he's not like a hands-on producer or whatever. And to me, there's just different ways of making records and different ways of making music. But what he is that is such an important thing, in my opinion, and something that we should all strive to be, is he's a fan of music. Like he's, from what I understand, he's basically a professional fan of music because he's not a self-proclaimed musician. He's not a recording engineer. None of that sort of technical stuff or whatever. He's somebody who listens to music and knows how to communicate to artists based upon what his he's a curator, basically, and like a professional fan. But he's turned that into a career as a record guy and as a producer. It's incredible. It's inspiring in that regard.
I want to play. There's a lot here. I don't know where to start. But why don't we do this one? I'm talking about Keith a minute ago. So here's the fighter.
Yeah.
Keith and Carrie.
Yeah.
Yeah, talk about this one for a second.
It was. We wrote this in London, actually, because Keith was living over there for a little bit. I think Nicole was on a play. And so the family was over there, and he was like, hey, you want to come over to London and write? And I was like, heck yeah. So we go, and...
Does he pay for all your trip if he says, do you want to come over and write?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it was one of those things where I would have done it either way, but, like, he's just, like, he's the best, man. He just, he's such a thoughtful and gracious person, you know? But, yeah, we went over there, and we hold up at this studio, Martin Tarefe's studio. It's this gorgeous, it's, like, on the fourth floor of this... kind of like old school English industrial complex from probably 150 years ago. And it's this massive A-frame and these huge windows. It's not even really soundproof. You can hear cars riding by and stuff. And the second day he comes in, he'd been working out in the morning. He comes in and he goes, I have this idea for a duet. And he starts singing it and he's showing me the couple parts. And within like 10 minutes, we're like, I've learned the parts. We've talked about it. And we're kind of like sort of singing it to each other. I was singing Carrie's part, you know, and it was like, oh, wow, this feels great. And then we just started building a track. And it wasn't really talked about, but I think our mutual fascination with the New Radicals really influenced that, you know, the way that sounds. And kind
the
of
New Radicals meaning the band, the New
yeah,
Radicals?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And it just, that song happened in just a few hours, literally. And then we did a little bit of stuff after the fact. And then once he locked in on having Carrie do it, it was like, well, where are we going to get the vocal done? How's that going to happen? And she had a day off. She was on tour. She had a day off in St. Louis. So I flew out there with my engineer. And Keith was actually cutting a video to Wasted Time in L.A. at the time. So he FaceTimed in. It was like this whole technology being our friend again, you know. And she just nailed it. I mean, she sang it in like 30 minutes, you know. It was, the whole thing was pretty effortless, which not every song is like that. And doesn't mean it's better or worse. It's just I feel like those are the gifts. When it's not only seemingly a quality song, but one that people are responding to, and then the process wasn't a huge rigmarole, but then most days it's a big rigmarole.
A guy like Keith, who is so advanced musically, but a guy like you, I assume you started playing the piano as a young kid.
Yeah.
You went to school on a jazz scholarship.
Yeah.
Trumpet or trombone?
Trombone.
Trombone. Yeah. Weren't you like declared greatest in the world at trombone?
I don't know about that. There is an award, a college age jazz trombone award, which that sentence alone is it's a pretty small demographic. No,
but
no
it's
offense.
Still again, data is still data.
It is true data, but it by definition of what it is, it basically is like it's available to all college age jazz trombone players in the world, and you apply and you audition, and I won that award. It's the Frank Rosalino Memorial Scholarship, which. To your point,
is the
I guess,
greatest trombone player in the world
of that age, I guess.
Yeah. There's dot, but I was
well. The only reason I actually feel comfortable talking about that with any candor is because it's not really what I'm doing anymore. But it's also just to demonstrate like how serious I was about it. This wasn't like I kind of played trombone in high school, like all the way up until I was about 21, maybe 22. All I listened to was jazz. Like I wasn't. Everything else was peripheral. Like. My sister was listening to hair metal. My dad was listening to some old country and black gospel and oldies. And my mom was listening to like hot AC version of country or of Christian music. Like Evie, have you heard this artist? Like this very, I forgot some of the other names, but like super hot AC, just like vocalist, but Christian music. So it's like this, you know, on one hand you have like Poison and and Guns N' Roses and Def Leppard and all this stuff, and then you have like Hank and Willie and Rock Around the Clock and black gospel music, and then my mom listening to like
Michael W. Smith.
Not even that progressive.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah, like
even back a bit.
Yeah, and more hot AC, more sort of church mom kind of vibe, you know.
So you had all these influences, and you were playing jazz. Were they musical?
My parents loved music, but no.
Okay, but they weren't. They didn't sit down and. So you were not in the band in high school. Did you play in the band?
I was in. Yeah, they made us. Parents made us take piano lessons from second grade through eighth grade. So that 6 year window, we all had to take them. No choice. And it was almost just like understood. It wasn't like the stories where you hear your parents like forcing you, but we didn't have a choice, so we just did it.
Were you really good? Like, were you, meaning there are things that I know I'm pretty good at.
Yeah.
And I can't always get better, but yeah, I'm pretty witty. I know that. And I can train myself to be a better comic, but I know that I feel comfortable.
Totally.
And I feel I see there's something there. Did you feel that way about the piano when you were young? Like, wow, I'm actually special at this.
It became evident over time because, you know, so much of that is your context, right? Like, you know you're witty because we respond to that, right? You aren't going to be witty in a vacuum. Like, and I'm not going to, like, know that I can play piano well in a vacuum. Like, once I realized I would go to some of these recitals and it was like, oh, I was placing in sort of the higher part of it, or every teacher I had was like, whoa, what's going on? That kind of vibe. It just, that made it more evident. And, you know, and then it became sort of, through, it was interesting. We joined band in fourth grade, and I played baritone horn, which is akin to a trombone, for a couple of years. And then I got bored and switched to tuba, and then played bari sax, and like just kept doing all these different instruments. And to me, it felt like just normal. It wasn't like this weird thing. But as I look back, it was like a kid that age just going, okay, I know how to play tuba now. I'm tired of this. Let me play bari. And the fact that my band director was cool about that, and not only cool about it, but helped foster that love for music really early on, you know.
What was the goal as a kid? Like, what did you think you wanted to do? Play jazz?
I just want to make music. I didn't even know specifically. I learned jazz in high school. That came across my radar, and I was just like, oh, wow, I just got the bug. And started, I had a couple friends in high school. We just totally hit it off, and we had a little jazz trio, and we just play. And our high school band director was amazing, Mr. Ernest. Mr. Vigas was the middle school one, and Mr. Ernest was the high school one, and he really helped foster the love for jazz. He's a great trumpet player. And I was able to take jazz courses in the evenings at the community college near my house where I grew up, which also, quote-unquote, happened to have a world-class tenor saxophonist from New York who became an educator and moved to the Bay Area and then taught in part at this community college. So it was like all this crazy, like...
Did you read Outliers, obviously? Have you read Outliers?
Yeah, totally.
Well, they talk about how Bill Gates just happened to be in the right... brilliant guy.
Totally.
But happened to have a computer.
Tons of them, yeah.
In his town.
Yeah. Well, and also the demographic of parents that he happened to be born to were upper middle class, which means he had the resources to be able to access the computer at the college. And in my own way, it's all that stuff. Like, and especially because there's so many different chapters of it that musically, and all of these people I quote unquote happened to run into. Like when I first moved to town, or I first started coming to town, I met through a friend of mine, Greg Becker, I met Daryl Franklin, who was Dan Hoff's business partner at the time, and am still really good friends with both of them. And that's the world I fell into, quote unquote, fell into, or was introduced to, was those guys. Those were my first publishers, Dan Hoff, Daryl Franklin. Like, it was just like, how does that happen? Well, because my buddy who I met through my other buddy who I met through my other buddy introduced me to a couple people, and one of them was Daryl. Like, it's just, when you look back on your life, when I look back on my life, let me say that, it's insane to look at those key moments, which there have been hundreds of them at different little moments that have really affected where I am and who I am. Super grateful for it, man. And I feel like some of it's divine intervention, you know. I can't explain the whys of it, but similarly to like how was I born with a unique ability? Like I'm like pretty okay at most things, and then in music it just goes psh, the spike, and then it's like okay, I'm back to being. And then how did that work? I didn't choose that. I mean, I've worked hard to develop it, but I know a lot of people who work hard and don't have a unique gifting in a specific area and don't get to do it, you know?
When you come to town, and Dan Huff, by the way, I spent time with him a couple weekends ago, and there were a lot of us there, and Dan, I was like, Dan, listen, I know there are a lot of artists here, but you're the only guy I want to take a picture with. Because Dan Huff, I mean, just his guitar.
Oh, yeah. He's a guitar hero, literally.
Hero?
Yeah. I love talking. I'm not a guitar player. So,
but do you play guitar? You say you're not a guitar player.
No, like, I mean, I could play acoustic. But
is it like somebody go, I'm not a golfer, but then they go out and they
I promise like six, you.
Okay.
Yeah, no. This straight up, like, I know-ish how to play guitar, and I could play some my songs on acoustic, but I'm not a guitar player, which I'm, for many reasons, I'm grateful for. I wish I was at times, but when I hang with Dan, it's like, I just get to hang and I don't have to guitar nerd out, but I love talking to guitar players about him because they just like start shaking. And I know how amazing he is because I'm a musician and he's like insane.
I asked him, we were sitting beside each other and we were shooting a thing. And I said, hey, we were talking about Thomas Rush's record and because Dan produced some of the tracks on it. And I was like, really though, Dan? Like, how many times are you in there when you're producing and there's a studio? And listen, to be a studio player in Nashville, you have to be phenomenal.
Yeah.
And you just want to go, let me do it.
Yeah.
Like, and he was like, you know, sometimes I would go home and I would be by myself. And I would think, I would be like, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
Like, with you musically, do you face the same struggle sometimes where you're like, man, I could really nail this. I can nail this keys part. I know it.
Well, it's funny because I probably am strongest on piano. Like, I play bass on a lot of the records I produce, but I'm definitely strongest on piano. That's an instrument I would actually potentially play professionally. But I'm happy to not play. And I actually really enjoy, as a producer, sort of utilizing different colors. Because I play the piano like I play the piano. And I know what that is. I know what it sounds like. I know what I'm going to do because I do it. And it's not always the same, but there's the similar colors that I go for. If I hire somebody else, like this week, tomorrow I'm cutting some tracks, and Ian Fitchuk is playing keys. And he's a brilliant multi-instrumentalist. He plays piano in a way that's different to the way I play piano. And he plays B3 in certain ways. He kills me on B3. Like, he just crushes me. Certain things I do, I'd rather have me do it. But more important than all of that, I like the variation. So it's amazing to be able to go, give me your version of blue. Give me this other color that you do that I've never heard of. And then how can I use that to help paint? I mean, it sounds loosey-goosey, but that's the way I think about it.
How about, I got a whole catalog here. And once I started going, you know what? I want to switch it up a little bit. You know what song I love? Is this one right here. This new Pink song, Try. Yeah. I love this song.
Yeah.
I like Pink a lot. Yeah. Back when I was working pop, because I spent a lot of time doing pop.
Yeah.
Pink was always really cool with me, because she was like human.
Oh, dude, she's really cool.
Like, in the land of the non-human, which is the pop world.
Yeah, yeah.
She was always really human.
You know, the thing that I won't pretend to know her super well. I've written with her 4 or 5 times. The thing that strikes me about her is that she's an eminent professional in a world that is, it's not like our world is unprofessional, but it's so, it just permeates all aspects of so many people's lives. She is a professional in the sense of like, when it's time to get on the road, she prepares herself mentally, physically for all that stuff. And, you know, if you've seen her show, she does all this. Like,
she flies around.
Yeah, it's insane. So she gets back to her weight training and all those things because she needs all those muscles for all of that throughout normal day life, you don't need it. And then, and you know, mentally and whatever, and she goes and does that thing. And then, you know, I think her family's still around and they travel with her. But when she's not doing that, she's chilling, man. She's at home doing what she wants to be doing, apparently. I'm making some assumptions here. But it's like this balance that is really inspiring. You know, when we wrote, she wanted to ride in Venice because I think they have a house there. And she wanted to be able to ride her bike to the studio. So it was like, this is the best. You know, she literally would like ride her bike down the main street of Venice, LA, down the sidewalk or whatever. Not in a spectacle kind of way, just her path where she was going. And she would show up at the studio and it was super low key. There was no bodyguards. There was no, it was just her.
And so, was that like two-way, you and Pink?
Yeah. Everything we've written has been a two-way.
Did you feel special about that one when you wrote it?
That one, I did. That actually I wrote with my buddy Ben West. That was
you've written with Pink a bunch of times, but you didn't write that one with Pink.
No. That one actually has an interesting story because she doesn't really take outside songs. You know, she's a brilliant songwriter and a huge hit songwriter. But I'd written that song with my buddy Ben, who I was literally just with before I came here. He's staying at my place here. He's a great writer, producer, lives in Detroit, comes to Nashville a lot as well. And we just wrote it literally outside of Detroit for like we had a band we were doing for film and TV projects. We just made a band name and started writing songs, and we're going to pitch them for film and TV placements. And that was a song that I literally woke up with the chorus in my head, and then Ben and I got together and like fleshed the whole thing out. And we didn't know what it would be. We weren't thinking like this is going to be a top 40 hit. We were just thinking like this song feels amazing to us. Turning into my publisher, I'd be getting all these emails like, you know, everybody's playing it in the Berlin office. My buddy Thomas would be like, I'm walking down the office. 3 months later, he'd hear it coming out of multiple offices. It was like, what a trip. So my publisher then sent it to our friend Rainey at RCA, and we'd cut that one again on another artist. It wasn't the right fit. After the fact, I've had a couple other artists tell me, oh, I wanted that song, but they wouldn't, you know. And then when I called Rainey to tell her, hey, this first artist we're cutting it on, super talented, but it's not the right fit. I kind of need to take the song back. She was like, well, can I keep it and play it for Pink? And I was like, yes, please. And then we got word that she loved it, that she was cutting it. And then eventually it was going to be her second single. And all the stuff that they told us was going to happen actually happened, which I really respect about her team. They're very like, this is what it is.
Did it help that you had a relationship with her a bit? Because, again, I assume she wrote it with you because she doesn't take a lot of outside songs.
No, I didn't know her at the time.
So this is before you guys. Yeah. Did that then make the bridge to know her and to start writing?
Oh, totally,
that,
yeah.
That was the bridge?
Totally. So, like, you know, a couple of years later, she had been taking time off or whatever, and I was like, man, I wonder if she's writing again. So I literally just hit her up, and we're like, hey, we have this other song. There's another song in my catalog that I feel is special in a similar way to this song. And she immediately responded to it and put it on hold, and we're like, I was like, oh, man, here we go again. This is going to be amazing. Unfortunately, that song then came off hold like a year later. I would have kept it for her for years because I think she's the right artist for it. But as a result of that, I got a call 3 weeks later. Hey, can you go write with her for a film? And so I went out to Malibu where she wanted to write. And it was for this song, this movie, Suffragettes. It's an incredible movie. It's about the women's movement in England in the early turn of the century. And I sat there. This is the only time I've done something like this. I sat there at her request and watched the film start to finish. She showed up about halfway through because she'd already seen it. And, you know, big hug. And then we pushed play on the film. We finished watching it. And at the end, we're both literally crying. It's like this emotional film. And then I as she went to the restroom, I took out my phone and, like, pulled up the GarageBand app to see what key the end of the score was in. Because we were going for the end title, and I wanted to write in the same key. Fortunately, it was in the key of C, which is like the best piano key. It's so easy to play in. So I just sit down on the piano, and I start like playing chords and just trying to create emotions that reflected what the film made me feel. And she had, dude, she's like, again, professional. She had pages of verses. She was reading me all these lyrical verses. It was like poetry, but they were actual verses. And it was verse after verse. I was just going, oh, my God, these are amazing. But then as a writer, I'm thinking, I don't know what the hook's going to be. I'm waiting for the hook. Where's the hook? And just in passing, she was reading. She's like, and wild hearts can't be broken. And da-da. And I was like, that's our hook. So we wrote this song, and then we just started playing the chorus and put it all together. And it's actually on her current album that comes out shortly.
That's a cool story.
Dude, she is...
I like it that you watch the credits and try to figure out what key it is so it can fit.
Well, I want it to be cohesive because I want it just seamless. I want it to go from the score right into her amazing voice.
And that movie's not out yet, right? Or is it?
That movie came and went. Sadly, it should have been a bigger hit than it was. It's amazing. Carey Mulligan, Meryl Streep. Oh,
Meryl Streep was in a movie and it came and went. That's a
I don't mean came and went. It did its thing, but it wasn't as big as it really should have been. It's incredible, man.
What's it called?
Suffragette.
Let me play this one right here. This is another one of those where I think Thomas had it first.
Yeah.
It's funny to tell because. Like, I love this song.
How do you find out stuff like that?
Because I have a lot of friends.
I know, but you just like...
I write songs. You know, I goof around and write songs to people. Yeah. And, you know, we do stuff.
It's fun, yeah.
And so they're always like, yeah, I don't know. And then also songwriters come in here and just spill their guts. And they're
totally.
You know, but...
They forget it's being broadcast to millions of people.
It's almost though like...
You're so disarming. That's the... That damn it, Bill.
For me, I think if you make it a thing, it's a thing. And if you're open and honest about it, there's no stigma. No,
it really wasn't
anymore.
A thing. And for me as a writer and professionally, you know, the things that – it's always funny when people make you sign NDAs, like, which hasn't happened that often. But it's like by nature of the fact that I want to work in this industry, I'm not going to talk smack about somebody in a public capacity ever. Like, why would you do that, right? It just doesn't make any sense. But anyways, to the point with that song, it was on hold with TR. And I had gotten word that Charles really dug it. And this was before he had called and they had asked me to work on their album. I got word that he dug it and he wanted to get the demo track to put his voice on just to see how that worked. And I don't think that ever happened. But I knew he was into it. And then when they asked me to come work with him, I kind of thought, let me put this in the back pocket, because he asked, like, let's, he was like, let's do maybe six songs and just see how what evolves. And I wanted to be very respectful of their creative process and not come in and just go, yeah, I know you guys want to write a lot of this, but here's a song you should cut. Just see what happens. And the first half, you know, that first six, what turned into be eight songs, just went really well. I've known them for years. It was just this big family vibe, basically, in a great way.
Did you go down to the house in Florida?
No, just after that is when I got the call. But I had asked them to come to LA if they wanted to, and they were willing. And so they came out and they stayed at a place in Hollywood Hills, and we worked at a buddy's home studio. It's like multi-million-dollar gorgeous studio in Toluca Lake. A beautiful home. He's got this like feral cat in a cage and like like this beautiful swimming pool. It was a great vibe. But so we did the first half, and then come to the second half of the album, and I just was like, you know what, I'm going to play this for them. I think they need to hear this song. I think it'd be a good fit for what's going on. And in the meantime, I had been in communication with Virginia, seeing what TR was in.
Who's Thomas's manager?
Yeah, Thomas's manager. Yeah. She's awesome. And ultimately, it was like, you know what, he loves it, but it's just not right for what he's wanting to do or whatever. So I was like, no problem. And then wound up playing it for them, and they were like, this is it. This is our first single. I mean, Charles, as you know, is so energetic and so in the moment. Something I really admire and appreciate about him. And in the context of them, they all have their superpowers. One of his is that, like, I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking. It's going to be real. It's going to be energetic. It's going to be right now. And immediately he was like, this is going to be our first single. And I was like, that would be awesome. And sure enough, it was.
So, I mean, when the record gets nominated for Record of the Year,
ugh.
I mean, that's a thing.
Yeah, that felt really... It's gratifying, man. I was talking to my publisher today. I'm grateful for recognition of our art. You know, I don't live for awards. They actually all, I put them all in my closet, besides the ones I've given to a few family members. I'm grateful for them. I'm not trying to diminish them, but I just put them there because it's kind of a reminder of what happened, and I'm looking for what's going to happen next. You know, and I don't want to ever like rest on any accolades or any of those types of things. But those types of awards, where it's like of all the albums that happened, we're going to nominate this as one of them. And especially for them in that process, they were taking a chance in a lot of things that they were doing and wanting to turn a page and uncover some new earth. And when that's recognized in a way that feels impactful, it's like, okay, we weren't out of our minds, you know?
Well, listen, they took a chance at just sonically. They like horns. A lot
yeah.
of horns.
Yeah.
That's a chance.
Yeah, on totally.
Country radio.
Yeah.
That's a chance.
But it's funny, man, the other side of that story, you know, I didn't even put horns on that song because I'm a trombone player. Like, I don't walk around thinking that I'm a horn player. Like, I haven't been, you gotta understand, man, I haven't been a trombone player in any professional or real, I mean, I haven't literally proactively played the trombone for probably 18 years or something like that. Like, I literally just set it down. It's like being a track star. You have to work at it every day, and it's that frustrating. If you don't work out, you're not gonna run fast. So,
it's like being a golfer. If you don't practice all the time, you can lose your swing.
You lose it. So, I didn't put horns on there because I'm a trombone player. I put horns on there because I was like, this would be rad to have horns. And we wrote it with Ryan Hurd and Hillary, thinking it would be for Ryan at the time. And Ryan had played a show. Derek Wells does these nights over, I think it's the Basement East, where they're themed nights. And this was the 90s night. And I don't want to specify what song it was, just in case there's any weird connections. But he had played a song, and with the band, it had a certain feel that had really nothing to do with the original version, but it just felt like, oh my gosh. And we felt inspired by that. And I was like, we should have a song that feels like that for you, you know? And so we wrote it with Hillary, and then ultimately, for whatever reason, it wasn't right for Ryan. And then you're like, oh, but then everything lands where it's supposed to land, man. It's hard to believe that when things aren't connecting, but it's always true.
You know, this one here. I'm gonna wish I had a storm warning. Go back a little bit. To
yeah.
Hunter and Storm Warning.
Yeah.
I mean, you wrote this one.
Yeah.
How early in the national process was this for you?
It was early-ish, maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe something like that.
Okay, see, you've been here a bit.
Dude, I've been coming to Nashville for 11 years. Like, when I say coming to Nashville, I mean a week, a month for 11 years.
That's a grind. Like, just travel.
Total grind.
Regardless of the work, yeah. Like, that's a week. That's a grind.
I mean, my publisher gave me a private jet, so it's been easy. No.
Yeah.
Could you imagine?
Not good imagine. That'd be amazing.
It's Southwest, man. Literally every month. And
but
now,
you're A-list, right? At this point, like me,
I'm A-list.
A-list with a companion.
Exactly.
So, dude, I'm flying with a buddy, too,
it's
for free.
It's the best.
So you talk about Storm Warning for a second.
Yeah, Hunter was, you know, this is his first album, so there wasn't, I mean, first album in Nashville proper and on a label and all that stuff. But, you know, and it was, I was given the prep of like, yeah, he's like this, he was a boy wonder, you know, Zydeco, multi-instrumentalist, whatever. And he comes in and he's just like this super energetic, really nice dude who's obviously multifacetedly talented. And we just, that idea came up and it was with Gordy and Hunter. I remember we wrote in that shack where Gordy's written a lot of great songs over the years. And it just came out. It was just one of those, you know, you never know, man. Not never, but like, I wrote Try in my buddy's studio an hour and a half outside of Detroit thinking it was this and it becomes this. And like, you just try to show up and write the best song you can and hope it lands.
How about this one? Can I get a hallelujah? I mean, I see your face whenever I play it. Like, there's an emotion where it's almost like, I read this book called I'm Okay, You're Okay.
Yeah.
And I'll go a little psycho babble on you for a second because I enjoy psycho babble.
That's great.
But they talk about when you hear a song, your brain reacts even for a split second.
Yeah.
It puts you back to the place that you were whenever you heard it for the first time.
Yeah.
You created it, whatever it is. Like, for just a split second, you feel that again.
Yeah.
And I watched your face and your head turn when you heard it again. Yeah. Even though you've heard it 10,000 times.
Yeah.
Tell me about this
one.
That
song never gets old to me. Like, it's just, it's special for a lot of reasons. Like, Marin was the first artist. I do artist development as a profession, right? I sign people to me. Carly's part of that process. Marin was prior to that in a professional sense. But being there so early on, it emotionally had a lot of that same connection, you know? And seeing her in those early days, I remember, I mean, I've told people when I first heard Marin sing, it was at Lucy Silvas' house. It's a long story, but let me tell you the quick version. My friend Nadine, who is day-to-day with Shakira, is like a manager, came to town, and I wanted her to experience Nashville at its fullest. She's a wonderful person. I wanted to, like, pull out all the stops for her. So I was like, you got to go see a writer's round. But none of the rounds that I saw for that week were people I had known or things or whatever. So I was like, oh, we'll just put one together, which I don't even know why I thought to do that. It just seemed to make sense. So I hit up Lucy, John Green, Barry Dean, all of whom are very soulful singers, great songwriters. And we decided to do Lucy's house, Lucy and John's in East Nashville. It's tall ceilings like this with brick walls, very reverberant old house. And she and I were talking a little bit about it, and Lucy, and she goes, you should invite that girl Marin. You know, you wrote with her a couple weeks ago. She's great. You should hear her. You know, I was like, okay, great. So I called Marin and was like, hey, I know we only wrote once, but you want to come do this thing? And the five of us with my friend Nadine and her friend, John's manager, and my wife, nine of us were in the house just doing a round. And it felt like we're at either Bluebird or anywhere. I mean, it was that awesome for all of us there. We were such fans of each other. But when I heard Marin sing her songs with her lyrics, it was, I mean, I wasn't there when Sheryl Crow was discovered. I wasn't there when Adele was discovered. But it felt like that urgency and that importance. Like, straight up, I remember telling my wife, I called Derek Wells the next day. It was like, dude, I've never heard anything like this. I've never heard somebody sing like this. I've never heard somebody communicate. Like, I have to be a part of this, you know? I don't know. And then I called her up. I'm like, what's going on? Are you doing the artist thing? Like, and can I produce? I'll do anything. Like, I'll pay for the players. I don't care. Like, whatever. If money's an issue, let me help. Like, I just want to be involved. And she's like, well, let's write and see what happens. And we did, and that evolved. And long story short, it turned out that I produced the project, most of the project. Some of it we co-produced with Brad Hill, who's amazing, and she co-produced it. And it's so much of our hearts were put into it because it was like, you know, when you, there was no clear path. We didn't know what it was going to be. It took, you know, she didn't have a label deal at the time. You know, she got signed to the deal. It took people like you playing that song, like all that stuff happened to then make it the hit commercially that it was, but I'm still connected back to the beginning of it, and it all came together. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do, and like I wonder the emotion. Like, what, when I played it again, I saw emotion for a split second. What's the, give me the word?
Gratitude. Truly, man, that song helped solidify some stuff for me. You know, I came up as a record producer and a songwriter, and I don't own either one of those things. It's not like they're mine to own. And I made a conscious decision to focus on writing because I like the lifestyle better. I like, if I had to choose one of the two, I would choose songwriting. And I decided if I would ever be able to produce again, then it would flow out of the songs. And that was the first song that I had produced that had a huge impact. Truly. I mean, that was the first hit I had as a producer. But even as a song, like being there when she walked in the studio that day, it was at my place in Glendale in LA. She had been driving up the PCH and she comes in and she goes, I want to write a song called My Church. And I was thinking, oh, that's cool. What's that about? She said, when I drive in the car and I'm listening to music I love, I feel like I'm connected to God. It feels like church to me. And if I remember correctly, I literally just picked up a guitar and was like, can I get a hallelujah? Because that's a phrase, you know. Can I get an amen? And she just starts singing the rest of the chorus, and we worked on it a bit, and then she writes the verses while I'm working on a track. And I think an hour and a half later, we'd finished it, and she sang a vocal.
That's super quick.
She sang a vocal in 30 minutes, and it was just – and because another beauty of it is like – and I like all sides of it, man. It's not that I only like staying under the radar and stay away from our creative process. I enjoy also when it's pressurizing. It's a new challenge, right? But that was so under the radar. There was no label deal in place. There was no specific expectation outside of us other than those who knew what was going on. We wanted it to be great. Her thing, you know? But there was no like – has to sell this many or has to do this. It was just, we're doing what we think is her and what's going to resonate, you know?
You talk about Maren. Let's talk about Carly for a second. Every little thing. Because you wrote this with her.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. You wrote it, then you produced it.
Yeah. This song is special for a lot of reasons to me. We wrote this with Emily Shackleton, who's an amazing songwriter. I mean, this is, if I'm not mistaken, her first top 10 as well as Carly's. And, you know, Daniel, my publisher, Daniel Lee, who's brilliant, he brought her to me because we made a conscious decision to invest in developing an artist. After the Maren thing happened, it was like, wow, I loved that process. I hadn't done much artist development in that capacity. Or I hate to say it about Maren like that. She is an artist, but I was involved early on. That's all I'm saying. With Carly,
it didn't come off. And
okay,
yeah. I would,
with Carly, it was. You know, she had so many things in place, but there was, you know, the music wasn't quite right yet. You know, and she knew that. She came to us going, "This is what I want to be doing. This is what I have." And she played it for us, and I was like, "Well, there's a discrepancy here. Let's figure out how we can figure that out." But she had also at the time, and man, it sounds like I'm gushing. I'm not trying to gush. You have been so helpful too with female artists, man. Like that is, and that's near and dear to my heart because I love all kinds of artists, but I love amazing singers. And historically, a lot of the amazing singers are females. Not that there's not great male singers, but like you think of all the way back, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, Whitney, you know, like, I mean, go on and on and on. There's, you know, those types of voice type singers, you know, big voices. And Carly, everyone had said no, basically. She'd been here since she was 18. Busting her ass, like not sitting on her butt, kind of going, kind of working and kind of hoping it's going to happen. And who's going to, when is, you know, only if only Bobby could play my independent song and I'll become, there was none of that. It was literally like busting her ass, doing the thing. And that more than anything is what drew Daniel and myself to her, is the work ethic, you know, and that, cause that's really what separates the men from the boys. You and I were talking earlier about our schedules. It's insane. You know that, man, we have to work crazy pants to do this thing. But for her, the key was really unlocking the music. And that song was a song that we had written where it was like, I remember her coming over and Emily was coming over and I was like, we don't have any ballads, which is never the case.
You know, right, it's like, usually the opposite.
I want up-tempos.
Right.
And I was like, and quite frankly, we were inspired by the fact that Cam was working. And that beautiful, and I was like, of course it's working. You have a great voice. You have an amazing, haunting, beautiful song. Why would it not work? Conceptually, I know it's not that easy, but it was like, all right, let's try to do that descriptor, a haunting, beautiful, amazing song, ballad with an amazing voice. And that song is the song that came out that day. And it just, I mean, anybody who's worked hard and has success deserves it. But that girl deserves it, man. It's been amazing to be a part of that story. And Emily, too. I mean, it's like, oh, that stuff, it just, I remember having my first hit. That was amazing. I was driving up to introduce my then fiance, girlfriend, shortly to become my fiance, to my parents. Now she's my wife. And on the way up, Daryl called and said, hey, Rascal Flatts is Summer Night's the next single. And I was like, oh man. And that was one of the best feelings as career wise, you know. But better than that, bro, and you probably know this, seeing someone you care about or involved in, invest in, them having a hit. That's just like, oh. So anyways, yeah.
This is your first hit, period.
Yeah, first single.
What's a hit to you?
let's say Radiohead.
Okay.
You know, it was the first radio single I had in a commercial sense. I had other songs that were released independent radio or that kind of thing, but the first, like, you know, commercial record label going to any sort of proper commercial radio.
People in those city can be like, "Hey, I heard your song." First time that ever happened. Totally. Like, someone from Pittsburgh call you and be like,
"Yeah,
hey."
It's funny. I always think of that song. People talk about the Eagle Cooler. You know that line? He's saying Igloo Cooler, but it sounds like Eagle Cooler to some people.
Oh, he's saying Igloo
Cooler. A lot of people are like, "What's an Eagle Cooler?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" We wrote that on Gary's back porch with Brett James. That was a fun day.
At LaVox's house?
Yeah.
Yeah, Gary's funny, huh?
Oh, he is one of the funniest people ever.
Yeah, I would see him. We used to live about four houses down from each other before I moved, and he would go work out in full camouflage, like long sleeve pants. And the first time I've told this part of the story. There's some guy on an exercise bike that kept waving at me in full camo, and I was like, "Who's working out in full?" And it was Gary. Right?
That's amazing.
But then I would see him there again working out in full camo.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "These are just the clothes that were laying around, so I put them on." And now it's like he disappeared. Like when they're not working.
Oh, dude.
Gary disappears into the woods, and it's like good luck finding him.
Totally, man. He's a big hunter.
he's a trip.
Yeah, he's a really good guy, man. I gotta say they were the first artists in town to really believe and invest in me. Like Jodan had heard some stuff I had written and sung the demos to. Back then I was singing a lot of my own songs, demos, because Dan had played him a song or whatever, however that worked. And so he reached out to write with me, and then Jay, and then Gary, and written with every combination of them. And my first cut was with them, commercial cut. It was a song called Better Now that I wrote with Greg Becker and Daryl Brown. And then my first single was with them. Literally, I mean, sort of happenstantially in that regard, but they've been amazing to me, man. They're just...
We talk about singers, and I know you produced this song here. You look alive like my name. With Lauren. Yeah. And I did that. I was on the radio. I was talking over the last couple of weeks. And I just like to make lists. I like lists to be controversial sometimes. I have different opinions. You know, I like to get people talking.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of it. But I did this whole list of underrated artists. And it's subjective. Completely subjective.
I think I just saw this today. Man.
I can
it's
put
amazing.
On there whoever I want. You know, and it's my opinion. It's not right, but it's my right.
Yeah, yeah.
But I put Lauren on there because when she's... Listen, there are... In the land of fantastic singers, then there's Lauren Elena. And there's that other 1% of the 1%.
Yeah.
And she's in that. And so you're producing... And I didn't know it until I saw it with my own eyeballs.
Yeah, no, she's... I was with Keith the other day, and he's a car guy. And he, you know, we were talking about a Bugatti that some friend of his had or whatever. And it's like, she's that of voices. Like, she is the elite race car of voices, you know. It's like,
and there are a lot of awesome race cars that cost a lot of money, but then there's that.
Yeah, this particular Bugatti I think sold for like £8 million. It was so rare, but she has so few limits to what she could do vocally. It's insane. Like, it is literally insane. And that was an interesting part of our process. You know, of course, it when you're making a record, as an aside, it's like being in camp. You know, like you go to camp. You all become this family for a period of time, and then someone blows the whistle and goes, "Camp's over," and you're like, "Crap, man, we have to go home." And then you miss each other, and then you're like, "What happened? We had so much fun at camp, you know." But anyways, when we were making that record with her, she'd come out to LA to record some vocals, and you know, again, to keep the analogy going, it was like I'd taken the Bugatti out to the track, and the engine was sputtering. And I'm like, what the heck is going on? This is a finely tuned machine. And she was having vocal challenges. And what ultimately wound up being, she had to have vocal surgery, which understandably she was super freaked out about that, because that's like, that's not only her livelihood, but it's her passion. Like, and you know, that's who she is. And I, you know, I couldn't guarantee her of anything. I'm not a doctor, but I was like, I've had multiple friends go through that. I bet you anything, it'll actually be better on the backside. Not just back to where you were, but even better.
And ended up being.
Yeah, and she's got more control even and more. And how do you improve on what she had? But it's crazy, man. Her naturally born, and obviously she's worked on it too, but naturally gifted ability is just like, ugh, out of control.
She would send me the throat. Inside the throat looks like a vagina. And she would send me pictures of her throat.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would, for a second, I was like, and I knew she wasn't sending me pictures of her vagina, yeah, but exactly. It looked, whenever someone sends you that picture, and I haven't even seen that many vaginas in my life. I'll be
honest
with you.
You're
like, whoa, it's your throat.
Exactly.
She was like, I've gained. She's like, I'm able to sing places now that I wasn't able to sing. And she already, these kids, and she was definitely a kid when she went on a talent show. to go on these talent shows, and you can write people off and go, a talent show, culture. Yeah. You have to be able to sing to go on these live talent shows and be successful. Totally. And so it's like when the Daniel Bradburys, the Lauren Elenas, and Kelly Pickler will blow the roof off the place singing. And so Lauren is that, and then plus.
Yeah. No, it was the amazing part about working with her is that I don't think there was anything I could ask her to sing that she couldn't do. Marin would probably say the same thing in the sense of like, I'm always telling them there's things they can do that they don't think they can do. Not because I'm trying to be silly, because I feel like I understand how far they can go and try to push that in a sense, usually hitting a particular note or whatever. But then some of the trick too is learning how to go. Cause I mean, Lauren could do anything like vocally. So she'll be listening back to her takes and like singing riffs over the top of them that she could. And so it's almost like also knowing like when to restrain yourself, because just because you can go 180 miles an hour doesn't mean that's what you should do on I-65. You know, if you're going to drive your Bugatti down to the row, you know what I mean? So it's, as a producer, that's part of the trick, is being not the governor, like it's my call, but like helping her know where those parameters should be, you know, and really gunning it, so to speak, at those right times.
Did Keith take you out in the Batmobile? Did you guys go drive? Did he let you drive it?
You know, it's kind of embarrassing. I can't fit in that thing. He has that Bugatti. If you're talking about the Bugatti, yeah, it is. It's like tiny. I'm 6'4", 250 pounds. Like, I'm a big dude, man.
Did you try to get in it?
Literally. I mean, when I say I can't fit in it, I can fit in it, but I couldn't drive it.
Not comfortably to drive it.
No. Right? He would have probably let me. He's the best, man. Like, it's just...
What's the goal? Like, now, what's the goal?
To stay married to the same woman and be a good husband and father, truly. That's it. Like, all this other stuff I'm grateful for, and I obsess over it. I love what we do. It's not that it's not important. It's stupidly important. But if you're going to ask me that, I think as big picture as I can, and that's what I come up with. Like, I want to be there at 70 when, you know, Bobby Bones isn't calling me going, hey, be on my podcast, because I'm 70 and no one cares who I am, with that woman and with those kids thriving, you know, and hopefully living a life where people go, that dude impacted me, he cared, you know. Because it's like, all this other stuff is amazing, man. I get to write songs, and people pay me to write songs and produce records. It's incredible. It's what I was made to do. I'm so grateful. But it's not even just the conversation of like, how quick does a song go off the radio? Like, who was the Grammy Award winning song of 1989? It would take me hours of asking people without Googling it. No one would know. In 1989, though, it was the biggest thing. And it was huge and impactful, and it mattered to everybody. I'm not saying it's no longer important, but what's important in that regard comes and goes.
I'm curious now. Let's see if we can figure it. Let's just take a guess. Might Google it, what the Grammy Award winning song
is. I might have my years off, but I do know what I think the song
is. Hold on. Let me see what I can do then. 1989. Yeah. Now, I got to think of where.
Do you have it?
I would go to where the... Is it something that I know?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
So, 89...
Can you show me? I want to make sure it's...
Oh, well, no, I want you to...
I've looked before.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll wait for you, yeah.
I want to work backward.
Yeah.
There's a Kiss from a Rose.
That's not early 90s,
that's
right?
Like, yeah. That's like 94. I would guess that's like 94, 95-ish.
Three, maybe. Yeah.
Okay. 89 was pre... I'm going to go with The Bodyguard. That's still
no, that's early. 90s.
Yeah, that 89's early.
Yeah, it is. It's tricky.
89.
And you know what's other tricky? What's also tricky about that time is the songs that we tend to remember are like the rockish leaning ones that weren't typically the Grammy Award winning songs of the year. This song, if it's the one I'm thinking of, is a huge song. But
is sorry. It?
It's, I'll give you one. It sounds like it should have come out before 89.
Nah, I don't even know. What is it? What do you think it is?
If it's the right one, it's Wind Beneath My Wings, but I might have the wrong year.
No. What is it?
Don't Worry, Be Happy.
Oh, there you go.
Wow, that one.
That's a bad example. The example I had was, because we do still love and care about that song.
That song.
But it's like, you know, the point remains.
We didn't remember, though.
The stuff that, I mean, that is just preeminently important in our work comes and goes. And I don't mean that flippantly, man. It's not like nothing matters, because right. you could go all Lamentations on it, which truly, in the grander scheme of things, what is anything, you know? But it's not actually just the work that matters, you know? It's the relationships, it's the the heart, you know, and that's something that it's tricky to remember that stuff. I struggle with that because it's if like you did ask me, that's what's really the most important to me. But sometimes my life only reflects the business part of it, you know, as opposed to the relational part. Not that the relationships don't matter, but like prioritizing, taking the moment and going like, how are you doing, man? Like, what's really going on? Like, are you good? Like, is everything cool? Do you need to talk? I'm here, you know, because that stuff matters, man. That really does. And it's not, again, that's the stuff that happens behind closed doors in secret. You're never applauded for, you know, but those are the things that echo heaven, so to speak, you know. That's the stuff that matters.
Who do you go to when it's, you're like, I'm stuck or I'm in trouble with, and not like it's a law, but like, yeah, creatively I'm in trouble. Like, I don't really know. Who's your guy? Who's your girl?
I mean, I talk to my wife about that stuff. I talk to my publisher, my pastor, my best friends, you know, I'm just, all of it's one big conversation, truly. And several other writer friends, you know, the thing I've learned or been learning is whatever I struggle, typically it's not unique to me. Just because we don't talk about it in normal conversation doesn't mean other people aren't going through the same things.
Yeah, you say that. So I wrote this book, right? And yeah. I wrote a book, and it did well. It was a bestseller for a while. But I was really nervous at putting it out because I felt very alone in my story.
Totally.
Because I grew up a kid, and I didn't have a dad, and my mom was a drug addict, and she died in her 40s. And we went through some very tough times. And I thought, I'm going to tell the story, and I felt very alone my entire life. Felt very, like, nobody knew what I had been through. And it created this humongous chip on my shoulder because nobody knew what I had been through. I put this book out, and first of all, I was like, man, nobody's going to. I will go do shows, stand-up shows. People will come up to me and go, you told the story? I have the same story. Totally. And it blows my mind. I spent my whole life
totally
thinking I was alone.
Yep.
And then when I put this out, and people, if people would consume it, the amount of people that would come and go, hey, you're not alone. Like, dude. I was like, that, what you said there is what I experience now 100%. With something. And even the radio show where I talk and I'm vulnerable and I say things and I think, same thing.
And what you said there is the other part of it. Even if, like, your exact story is not my story, but when you throw the vulnerable card on the table, it creates an environment where, oh, I can be vulnerable, you know, and I'm learning that myself. Like, so often we have to lead. We have to go. No one's being vulnerable, but I'm feeling whatever. I'm going to just say it. Hey, are you guys struggling? Do you think that you're never going to have a hit song again, or that everyone thinks what you do is a joke, or whatever it is, you know? And everyone starts to go, wait, you feel that too? I feel it. And we start, you're able to talk about those things and just sort of like put the pin in a little bit, so to speak. Because, you know, we're all creatives, and as such, our brains are a little like extra wonky. And it comes with the tax, the emotional tax, right? Of having to deal with some of these extra insecurities and extra fears. I mean, we all have insecurities and fears, but it just seems somewhat heightened with creatives.
I always say to be different, you really have to be different. Yeah. Meaning, if you want to be different than the rest, you don't just go and be different and then you're the same the rest of you. Like,
totally.
Like, I'm a weird human, but that weirdness allows me to do different types of things and where I can flourish in certain areas, I really struggle in others.
Totally.
But that's what makes me different. Like, for me to be different, I am different.
And something that's tricky about that, or let me just speak for myself, it's been tricky because being this dude who's like, I was a jazz trombone player and I write pop songs and country songs and produce and publish and business and music and all together. It's like, it's not like you can just go, oh, I'm going to build a career just like this person, which you can't do that to begin with. But when you're sort of doing you, the path isn't laid out and it's scary. It really is, because everything in me constantly wants to go, like, who can I look to who's done the thing? And I definitely have mentors and people I admire, like Dan and other people like that, who I can call and have these real types of conversations with. But Dan Huff's career is totally different than the career I'm working on and where that's headed. And even if I try to replicate his career, it's not possible. You know, his is unique to him, and Mutt Lang's is unique to him, and Quincy's to him, and da 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 da. It's everybody. You know, I'm not saying I'm in that. What you can't hear on the podcast, my hand is going up because those are the
I never super, saw his hand move. I saw his hand go down actually as he was doing it.
The
he
levels like of super down. Producers, yes. You know, that you look up to, and like those, you just have, you do you, you know, because this is the other way I try to look at it. It's the cheesiest thing to say, but like, I'm the best Busby that's ever existed. I'm a horrible Bobby Bones. You're the best Bobby Bones that's ever existed. You'd be a horrible me, and vice versa, Mike. Like, it's, you got to be you, you know, and we need that Everyone, I need you to be you. You need me to be me. I need you to be you.
I appreciate the conversation. Man, you're way smarter than I am. Sometimes you sit beside somebody.
I was hoping you were going to say way smarter than I thought. I was gonna hug you.
No, it's just like you sit with people, and there are times where I talk, and there are times where I shut up because I feel like I can learn. This is definitely one of those times where I just shut up and just took some notes. Like I really appreciate the time. I know you're a busy dude.
Likewise, man. Thanks for taking time.
So I appreciate you stopping by and shedding the knowledge. Like I felt like I just went to a master. Like I paid $100 for a Steve Martin masterclass. I love Steve Martin.
Yeah, he's the best.
Creatively and in so many forms. He was selling out stadiums doing stand up when it just didn't make sense to you because you couldn't see him.
Totally.
And you couldn't hear him. You were just yelling through a PA.
Yeah. literally.
Literally. So, you know, I bought the masterclass and I enjoyed it. But I paid $100 for it, right? Yeah. I love Steve Martin. But I feel like I just got a free Buzzy masterclass here.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. What episode is this, Mike?
84.
84. That's Buzzy, or as I call him, Mike. Does anybody call you Mike? What's your wife call you?
Dan Huff insists on trying to call me Mike or Michael, and he's trying to make as many people call me that. So Keith's been calling me Michael, and anyone Dan can influence to call me Michael. He thinks it bothers me. It doesn't. But thanks, Dan.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for appreciating it.
Thank you, man.
All right. Bye, everybody.